mushroom farming is fascinating. You heard a little bit about it on last week's episode. But for an indoor crop that already has demand generating $60 billion annually, it has a great climate story, a great nutrition story, and a lot of potential in the future. But as a crop, it's also very labor intensive.
When you have a crop that doubles in size every 24 hours, you're often picking mushrooms at the end of the shift because you know that they'll start colliding with other mushrooms or their caps will open up by the next morning. So you pick them too quickly. Whereas if you know I can come back in 3 hours and pick that, you'll gain the extra yield and weight that'll come with it. A robot is able to do that, that you know shift labor can't accommodate.
Sean O'Connor and the team at Forage Robotics are bringing automation to this industry, but they're not the first to have this idea, which means they have to work a little bit harder to gain farmers' trust.
Decades of people saying that we're going to solve harvesting through automation, much like the rest of agriculture as well, and decades of people being wrong. So that barrier for acceptance of an MVP is very low, and you got to have something that truly adds value to them from day one.
Today is not only an education in mushroom farming, but a candid look into what it takes to bring technology to an established industry. Sean O'Connor of Forage Robotics on today's Future of Agriculture podcast. Hello, fellow Ag Nerd. Thank you so much for joining me for another episode of the Future of Agriculture. My name is Tim Hamrich, and every week you and I get to hear from the founders, farmers, innovators, and investors, the people shaping the future of the ag industry. Before we dive into today's episode with Sean O'Connor, I'd like to take just a moment to recognize our quarterly presenting sponsor, which this quarter is Headstorm, engineering growth for the farms of tomorrow. Headstorm is a full-service technology consultancy with been-there-done-that knowledge and expertise in the ag industry. The team at Headstorm knows which digital strategies work and which ones don't work based on the competitive landscape across broadacre, specialty, and animal ag industries. Headstorm provides a holistic and actionable technology roadmap that bridges the gap between strategy and implementation. From inception to execution, they'll help you play to your strengths, mitigate your weaknesses, and make technology your unfair advantage. Learn more at headstorm.com. That's headstorm.com. I'll leave a link for that in the show notes. And thank you so much to Headstorm for supporting Ag Innovation and the Future of Agriculture podcast. All right, now back to today's featured conversation with Sean O'Connor of Forage Robotics. And it may look to you like 4AG Robotics because they spell it with the number 4 and then AG, but it is pronounced Forage Robotics. And if you're like me and you've been calling it 4AG in your head every time you read it, that's okay too, but it's Forage Robotics. You might also know the company by its previous name, TechBrew Robotics. Anyway, the company is certainly making headway into mushroom automation, and this conversation I had with Sean O'Connor was one of the highlights for me of my time at World Agritech in March. This is another interview from World Agritech, which means you might have to deal with just a little bit of background noise in today's episode, but I promise it's not too bad. Sean is such a fun guy to chat with, no play on words intended there, and he's got a lot of great insights to share, not only about mushrooms, but about building companies and delivering technology that adds real value. A bit about Sean here, he's the CEO of Forage Robotics, as you know, which builds robots that harvest mushrooms. Before that, he was the managing director for Conexus Venture Capital, Inc. and Emmertech. Conexus Venture Capital's first fund is a 2019 $32 million fund focused on prairie-based startups. Emmertech is a $60 million early-stage Canadian ag tech fund. And before his time in ag tech venture capital there, he was on the leadership team of a Canadian fintech company, Grow Technologies, which was acquired by ATB. With that, I'm going to drop into this conversation with Sean O'Connor of Forage Robotics.
So I came from a fintech background. So we built a financial technology company in Canada that ended up being acquired by a bank, and then moved over to the world of venture capital and starting Conexus Venture Capital, and then Emmertech, which was, you know, the most active venture capital fund in agriculture in Canada. And as I built up the VC sides and started bringing on, you know, Kyle, who was a partner who ran the funds with me, and Rob and Aaron, and started seeing what like truly great VCs look like, I went, oh, geez, I think I might be better in the operator's chair. And so we, you know, built up the funds together, and you know, the team there has now taken them on and doing extraordinary things with them. One of our portfolio companies hit some tough times last year and needed some additional support. So I came in on an interim basis. And then the founder asked if I would stay on long term, and the board did as well in the summer. And you know, I haven't looked back since. So I went from being a fintech nerd to someone who's quickly learning about venture capital and egg tech. And now I know far more about mushrooms than I ever thought I would.
Well, I'm prepared to learn a lot more here. I don't know much either, but I will say that your description of wanting to go back to operating sounded like a very humble Canadian way of saying you just missed being an operator.
I did. You know, it's you get to move the needle every day. You get to break stuff and move quickly. Like, it's the pace at which you can operate as an operator, you know, how quickly your decisions can turn into your actual impact. I just find that thrilling. And so for me, that was super exciting. And I convinced one of the leaders at the fintech company, Grow Technologies, his name's Chris Payne. He was living in Vancouver, and I had a conversation with him. I said, "Hey, Chris, what do you know about mushrooms? Will you move out to Salmon Arm with me and help me run this mushroom robotics company?" And now he's out living there too.
He did?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, wow. So we don't have to go too much into it, but what was the fintech company? You said Grow?
Yeah, Grow Technologies. So we built a company that we essentially tried to replicate what Lending Club and Prosper did in the US.
Yeah. And then I was an early Prosper lender.
No way. Right on. Oh, man, it was such a cool program. Now, the regulatory approach in the US was different in Canada, but Kevin Sandu is the founder of Grow. And so I met him back in 2014. And we built a company that it started off as the Lending Club or Prosper of Canada. And then we realized we were better at the actual technology side of things. And we kind of sold our souls and licensed our technology to the Canadian banks. And look, it allows for a way more smooth experience banking with banks in Canada, and then one of them acquired us.
Wow, very cool. Well, it sounds like for you, there was a bit of an extenuating circumstance that led to helping the company and then being CEO. But what did the pitch look like for your was it a co-founder, I guess, your previous co-founder, to say, like, haven't you always dreamed of being in mushroom automation?
Yeah, so the founder, Mike, you know, he's a super experienced leader in the robotics space in Canada. And so that was the first piece. I really believed in him as being an exceptional founder. And then he started talking about the mushroom industry, which I was learning quite a bit about agriculture. We were deploying lots of money into great ag tech companies across, you know, Canada and Australia. But I didn't realize, like, how big of a problem this is, where you've got a $60 billion industry that people are showing up and picking mushrooms every single day of the year. You know, your average farm will do, you know, upwards of 12 crops in a year in one growing room, and they'll have, you know, anywhere from 40 to 400 growing rooms across their operations. The complexity in how you coordinate harvesting mushrooms that are these super delicate crops, like more delicate than a tomato or strawberry. They double in size every 24 hours. They have to be declustered, or they start bumping into each other and, you know, deforming or competing for nutrients. And you have this really complex farming operations where, you know, people are picking mushrooms on a mushroom farm every day of the year. And so the team at TechBrew, now Forge Robotics, had built, you know, a really compelling prototype that was most of the way there, had shown that this can be done. And there's a deep graveyard of companies that have tried to solve mushroom harvesting because it is such a, you know, complex and challenging problem for farms around the world. And it just became clear that the way they were picking mushrooms was better, and the timing in the world of how computer vision and AI was finally ready to, you know, decipher what the what mushroom is a mushroom, and how a cluster of mushrooms aren't one big mushroom, and how you can predict how mushrooms will grow so you can pick the right one at the right time. For all those reasons, it was, you know, super compelling. So we invested a few years before I then moved over to CEO. And yeah, it's been a, you know, pretty neat journey so far.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So help us visualize a grow room. What's a grow room look like?
Yeah, good question. So a mushroom farm looks like a, you know, typical just industrial building where you've got these big industrial buildings, and you'll have a bunch of different rooms that are all kind of grow and harvest rooms. So your typical farm could have, we'll call it 40 rooms in it. And in that room, you'll have usually two or four Dutch racks, as they're called. There's aluminum racks that are in the farm, and they're usually about 20 or 40 meters long. They have six shelves to them, and they're anywhere from kind of 1.35 to 1.4 meters wide. And so in that room, you'll have a crop, and you'll bring in the, you know, the compost and mycelium and peat moss and gypsum, and you've push it all into the room onto these racks. And then after about 2 weeks of growing, they're ready to start harvesting. And then you harvest them for another 2 weeks if you're doing kind of a two flush system, which is quite typical. And then you empty out the room and start over again. The farms are all quite large, but you know, on your standard kind of smaller farm, you'd have 20 to 40 rooms that are doing that all year round.
Yeah. So then what does a forage robot look like? Do you have a cute name for your robot? Robotics companies have to have cute names for like
the robots. I actually stole this from a company called Swarm Farm out of Australia that I'm a big fan of that creates autonomous tractors. And they let their customers name each robot. So we've actually started kind of going with that. But we're from a little town in Salmon Arm. And we've mostly been naming our robots that we're building internally after the lakes in British Columbia. I think that's going to take on a whole new personality as we start letting our robots name them. But, you know, the typical robot, it bolts on to a ground rail that we put alongside the racks, and it just goes back and forth 24 hours a day picking mushrooms exactly when they should be picked. Because, again, when you have a crop that doubles in size every 24 hours, if you're doing an 8-hour shift with human labor, you're often picking mushrooms at the end of the shift because you know that they'll start colliding with other mushrooms or their caps will open up by the next morning. So you pick them too quickly. Whereas if you know I can come back in 3 hours and pick that, you know, gain the extra yield and weight that'll come with it, a robot is able to do that, you know, shift labor can't accommodate.
Yeah, it sounds very similar to what, you know, Casey Call, I was just on the show talking about Zordi, you know, and they're doing their strawberries. So it sounds like then you would have one robot per grow room because they're stationary fixed to the floor.
You'd have one on each side of the rack. So if you've got two racks in there, you would have four robots in the room.
Okay.
And they would pick there for 2 weeks, 24 hours a day. And then once that grow room's done, you move them out into the next room. And then by the time the second room's done, the first one's ready to harvest again. So you've got this nice kind of cycle where they just go from one room back to the other over the course of a year.
Very cool. All right. So yeah, my next question was going to be about cost because that sounded like a lot of robots to buy. But no, if you can get by with like two and cover a lot of different grow rooms, that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. Like it still is a lot. Like our robots cost $250,000 Canadian. There's recurring fees that go on in terms of us sharing in the upside because you get more yield from robots picking mushrooms over 24 hours than you do over people picking every mushroom they can in an 8-hour shift. But the payback period is really the North Star that every farm is looking for. So if you can get the efficiencies out of the robots, so your payback period happens in 2 years or less, usually the farms are excited and open about working with us. And then they have kind of a staged approach for how they roll out the robots because, you know, many farms need about kind of 200 robots to outfit all of their farms. So $50 million of robots with, you know, the recurring fees that come with that. That's not a, you know, a small purchase. And so to be able to, you know, allow them to stagger the costs out, then also rolling out the robots too. Like in the perfect world, no one ever gets fired because of our robots and you have 40% of your staff turnover annually. So if you've got, you know, 1,000 people that are picking mushrooms, you're going to lose 400 people over the next year as they go on to do any other job because picking mushrooms out of chicken manure, bent over, climbing up and down racks all day is a pretty difficult way to make a living. It allows the farms to be able to deploy them in a method where they're not worried about, you know, the HR components, they're just hiring less people each year and replacing more with robots.
Gotcha. So I can't do that math in my head. What would the payback period be then for something like that?
Depends on where you are in the world. So in like Australia and New Zealand, you're probably looking at, you know, 17, 18 months. In Europe, you're looking at, you know, something around 20, 21 months. In Canada and North America, you'd be kind of 22 to 28 months, getting right around that, a little bit over the 2-year payback, which is where we need to, you know, do everything we can to decrease our costs or help find grants for farms or things like that.
Is there funding available for stuff like this in terms of grants?
There is, yeah, because one of the big pieces on graze harvesting with robots is you're able to increase the yield that produces from your farm without increasing the environmental intensity of your farm. So we had the Canadian government helped pay for a study that was done through a third-party carbon emissions auditor, and it found that your standard farm would save about 8.4 million kilograms of carbon dioxide a year by using robots through a graze harvesting process. And so that usually helps with farms, particularly with the first purchase, whether it's through a grant in the European Union or a grant in, you know, a couple of different groups here in the US and certainly in Canada, that's starting to build up as well. And that's really all we need is, you know, get our foot in the door, show them the ability for our robots to add an ROI to their farm. And then it just makes economic sense for them to be, you know, slowly purchasing the equipment as they roll it out across their operations.
What do you think has been the challenge up until forage robotics in getting something to work? I mean, why have so many tried and failed? And more importantly, why have you succeeded where they've failed, do you think?
So I think there's two things. One, we deserve a lot of credit for, and one, the world fixed for us. So the one that we deserve a lot of credit for is how you pick a mushroom is really challenging because they bruise and split so easily. And so we started off with a suction cup We go down on the mushroom, we put the suction cup on it, and we'd pull it off, and we'd trim it, and we'd pack it, and it would look, you know, beautiful and ready to go to the store. And then you leave it in the fridge for 5 or 6 hours, and it would develop these like hickeys, like these bruises that would go around them on the suction cup. And so, ah, God, no one's going to buy those mushrooms. Like, they look awful. And so we went back to the drawing board, and we started using kind of robotic grippers and tried using, you know, robotic fingers to pick them. And test of that, there's just no chance that's ever going to work to pick these tightly clustered mushrooms. And so we were damaging too many mushrooms, more often than neighboring mushrooms, through that, and realized that's not going to work. And so we went back to the suction cup, and we effectively created, you know, a novel approach where we were able to use a different type of material, a more flexible material that goes onto the mushroom. As we're going on the mushroom, we push down. And so what we're doing is we're increasing the surface area, kind of like an octopus on the mushroom. So you have maximum amount of surface area touching the mushroom before the suction process starts. And it's because of that, you spread all of that pressure out across the mushroom, and you no longer have that, you know, tight circle that was causing the friction and that bruise. And so that was a piece that we did really well. We did that about 2 years ago. We've picked, even with our V3 robot that was a failure, went on farm, it, you know, it picked 15,000 pounds of mushrooms that were sold across grocery stores. It had a, you know, host of other issues, which is why it was not sellable. But we proved that we could pick a mushroom without damaging it. And then the second one that the world solved, and we've got, you know, incredible team here in place as well, is computer vision and AI needed to get to a point where you could identify mushrooms properly. And like, that sounds so silly, but a whole bunch of little white circles on a bed is actually really difficult to tell the difference between what's this one and what's that one. And are those four little mushrooms actually one big mushroom, which is a constant mistake that we used to make. And so computer vision and technology, whether it's through RGB or infrared technology, and how you identify the diameters of each mushrooms, how you map them out, because you actually map them like mountain ranges, not like little circles from above, because they have all these different depth to them too. And then how you identify where is the center point of each mushroom, which is important for picking it and not damaging it in the process. That's one where, you know, our computer vision and AI team deserves a lot of credit, but the smartest people in the world a decade ago were still going to struggle at saying, is that a mushroom this, you know, large bed of mushrooms.
And you mentioned decluttering or declustering. I don't remember what you called it earlier. Did the robots do that as well? Or you still need to pay people for that?
No, they do that as well. And that's tricky. So yeah, essentially in the opening the bunches or declustering process or thinning process, there's a whole bunch of different terminologies depending on the farm, is you've got all these little pins that are starting to poke up of robots. And so they're all tightly clustered together. And if you don't pick out some of those small mushrooms, they're going to both bump into each other and deform. And they're also going to start competing with each other for the nutrients, and you're going to lose the overall mass you can get off the bed. So you have to pick off some mushrooms to give them space. But even then, you can't pick the wrong mushrooms, because if you pick the wrong mushrooms, you're going to be picking the ones that are best primed to be the largest mushrooms, which means you're losing weight that comes from the bed as well. So we spent, you know, 4 years trying to build software that's just a, you know, effectively a bunch of if statements you stack on top of each other on trying to decide when and which mushrooms to pick. And this is one of those things on timing where the pace at which artificial intelligence and computer vision have now improved, our AI team, which is a new team that we built over the last year and a bit, they effectively were able to outcompete our software approach in a matter of less than a year. And effectively, that's just through smart image annotation to create pattern recognition. And so you're just trying to recreate, we've worked with a couple different farms around the world. You're trying to recreate the brains of their smartest harvesters on which mushrooms to pick into their robots. And so that's been the pathway to finally have something that is as good, if not better, at the thinning or declustering process to make sure you're never picking the one that's supposed to be the large mushroom by accident.
All right. So maybe you can clear something up for me, because I was talking to Evan at Ecovative, and I think he said something to the effect of like, there's like one mushroom that's commercially cultivated, and the different types of mushrooms you buy at the store are also all just like grown differently of the same type of mushroom. Is that right? And does your technology work for all of those?
Yeah, he's totally right. They're a super cool company. Yeah. So the Agaricus mushroom, which is your, you know, every different iteration of your standard white or brown mushroom, is effectively a different strain that's been created through that. And that's all our mushrooms pick. So we don't.
I had no idea.
Yeah. Like, look, that's not the same. We don't pick lion's mane or shiitake or, you know, some of the niche specialty mushrooms, but the industry itself, those aren't even the same growers. Like, they're, you know, the mushroom industry is about $60 billion annually. And, you know, over 90% of that is just white button, brown button mushrooms. You know, every country in the world typically has 2 to 5 large farms.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've interacted with, you know, row crop farmers, livestock farmers. Is a mushroom farmer any different? Kind of, you know, a lot of ways a farmer is a farmer.
You know, the culture of farming is pervasive across, I find, any industry, and mushroom farming is no different. Like, there is a zero BS approach to mushroom farming, same as anywhere else, that you better be as transparent as possible when you say what your robots can do and what they can't do, because the last thing they want to do is be sold something that's not actually true and able to perform today. And they've got a, you know, decades of people saying that we're going to solve harvesting through automation, much like the rest of agriculture as well, and decades of people being wrong and them having to, you know, essentially be stuck with the burden or the bill or the consequences of, you know, something that doesn't work. So that barrier for acceptance of an MVP is very low, and you got to have something that truly adds value to them from day one. That part is very similar. What's different though is mushroom farming used to be a lot of kind of small mom and pop style farms, much like you'd see in other farms across the US and Canada in different crops.
Now, they used to be grown in caves. I don't know why I thought they were grown in caves.
Totally. Yeah. I think initially, and there are still some places in the world that are either caves or replicating caves in terms of how they grow them. And so you had these smaller farms, you know, scattered around the world, and they slowly started consolidating, mostly through kind of one farm in the area would consolidate and purchase the other farms there, as you have, you know, better access to immigrant labor that you can pull in, as you have better cost of capital. And you start booking, you know, big deals with Walmart and huge distribution deals, and that requires more mushrooms. So you contract with some of these other smaller farms, and slowly they retire and you buy up their facilities. And so over the last kind of, sometime kind of the 80s to the 2010s, you had all this consolidation happening from family-owned farms. And then what we've seen over the last decade is it's a robot that structured and professional capital really likes. So pension funds, corporate capital, private equity. For a few reasons. One is it's on the transition to a plant-based diet, which is obviously gaining momentum. The second is, if you don't like, you know, commodity risk is the wrong term, but if you don't like the risk that happens when you have costs in the spring and revenue in the fall, and that gap that can happen on commodity risk in that period of time, mushrooms are wonderful because your costs and your revenue are weeks apart as opposed to months apart. And then the last piece is, it's, you know, a very climate-friendly crop to be growing. And so if you want to invest in that space because of the impact, or you want to invest in that space because you're afraid of how drought or heavy winters will impact a crop, farms are all grown indoors in climate controlled facilities. You've got all these trends that over the last decade have started bringing private equity and pension capital and corporate capital into the mushroom farming space, which is changing the dynamic quickly. Like, still some of the largest farms in the world are still family owned. But increasingly, more and more of them are owned by pension and private equity capital.
Right. Might be the only vertical farming that I can get behind right now. The only one that makes sense to me.
Yeah, it's one that's been proven for 40 years, right? Like, it was interesting kind of watching the, you know, dynamic of vertical farming over the last few years and the rise and fall of it. And all these mushroom farms being like, hey, we did this, you know, in the 80s and it works. It's totally different. But, you know, it's one that's been proven to be able to just churn out quality crop that could be consumed, you know, within a day anywhere in the world if there's a mushroom farm close.
Talk to me about this really interesting dynamic of farmers having been burned by this promise so many times in the past. I know you said you have to prove it. You have to prove your value. But how? Are they even willing to talk to you? Do you have to give it away for free? You know, what do you do?
Yeah, so we got really lucky. We're a large farm in Canada called Highline, and then a large farm in the Netherlands called Bonken, you know, took a leap of faith where they bought the 4 robots from us.
Why?
Because I think they know that if we can solve this problem, and certainly they're, you know, incredibly bright farmers who can help us solve the problem as well, that we can make a lasting and significant difference to their business when it comes to the economics of their business, the reliability, you know, being able to deliver farms consistently. And so I think, you know, we got very fortunate to have a farm that was, or 2 farms that were ready to take a leap of faith with us.
And then, are they close by you?
So Highline in Canada is. So we've got 4 robots now picking mushrooms today on farm in Abbotsford, in a truly commercial third-party farm that we're not in control of. And their staff are telling the robots what they should be picking, when they should be picking. And that's huge. Like, now it's a proof point to the industry where, you know, I was on stage at a mushroom conference a couple weeks ago, which, yeah. I always wondered what a mushroom conference would be like, and certainly it was more professional than I expected. But I was on stage there.
I bet you were on stage.
Yeah, exactly, doing my dance. So being able to say you're on a farm that's not, you know, you're not an owner, it's not an owner of you that truly is using your robots in a commercial setting. Like, what a game changer for us as a proof point for the industry, and one that validates that we have something that works. Now, there's still some stuff we need to do to fix it. We have a robot that's picking mushrooms, matching the yield from other rooms that are being harvested by people. And yeah, you know, that's just meant the world to us over the last few months of being able to get there.
Very cool. So I know you talked about grants. My mind went elsewhere before I could ask about financing for something like this. Do interest rates really impact the ability to gain traction in this business just because it's more costly to finance something like this?
We haven't seen it yet. Like, these are very well capitalized businesses. And so from the perspective of them purchasing equipment, we've seen, you know, large availability of their own capital to buy these robots, you know, pending they do what they say they're going to do. So pending our robots are adding the value that we say they're going to, you know, they're typically making a small purchase of, you know, $1 to $2 million with robots at the start, and they need $25 to $100 million to roll them out across their operations once we prove on their farm that our robots can deliver the results they're looking for.
Yeah. Well, I know this isn't a delicate way of putting this, but your robots are quite literally taking jobs. How have you reconciled that, you know, both personally and as a company, to sort of, you know, come to terms with that?
You know, I'd say I haven't quite, and we're still navigating that in my own kind of journey. And us as a company, we're really sensitive to that. And look, this is a part of evolution that my great grandpa immigrated from Iceland to Canada to a little town called Gimli in Manitoba. And his first job was cutting ice on Lake Gimli for ice boxes. And it's like, my kids didn't believe that was a thing until the movie Frozen came out and the initial montage at the start of the movie has people cutting ice. And I said, I told you that was once a thing. You know, when the refrigerator came, there was not, you know, lineups around the block of saying defend the ice cutting industry. But it is something that we're cognizant of. I'd say that the area that works out really well for us today is that the natural turnover of farms is so high that no one's ever getting fired because the robot's showing up. And so the piece that we're seeing now is, you know, workers who are on farm are going to be the ones who end up controlling and running the robots and running the logistics of how the robots are successful. So most are going to choose, you know, not to be in the mushroom industry, as you see about 40% of labor leaves the industry as harvesters each year. And those who stick around are going to have, you know, higher paying jobs where they're able to coordinate these robots to optimize them to increase yield. And so I think we've got time to figure out, you know, how we play a key role and whether we play a key role in making sure that we are offsetting the labor that'll be lost. But in the short term, no one's getting fired. It's just less people are going to be hired from different countries around the world to come in and pick mushrooms in, you know, whether it's Pennsylvania or Ontario, Canada, or the Netherlands or Ireland. And that's an area that I think, yeah, we still need to give a bit more thought to how we can play a role in that.
Mm-hmm. And what is the geography of the global mushroom industry? Is it pretty concentrated in certain areas?
No, it's spread out. It's everywhere. So largest producer in the world would be China. Second largest would be the US. Then I think you're, you know, close between Poland, the Netherlands, and Ireland, Canada, Australia is really, you know, large. And the reason for this is that the mushroom can't travel. So you can't grow mushrooms in, you know, Canada and send them across to Europe. So they need to be within a geographic distance that's close enough to the grocery store so you can get that mushroom from the bed to the store as fast as possible.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine you're constantly iterating on the product and its ability to return that. Are there other features down the road in the product roadmap that you're excited to explore down the road?
I think so. Like, look, we're a bunch of robotics and tech nerds in Canada, and we're not going to be able to build the best company in the world in this space without the support of great farms who are helping us. But some of the things we've highlighted, like disease detection, contamination detection, because, like, keep in mind, any contaminant in a farm that grows fungus is going to thrive. Oh, yeah. And so it gets out of control pretty quickly if you're not on top of it. And our robots will be able to detect it. Now, there'll also be less contaminants because you won't have people going in and out of rooms. And that's really the carrier that you typically see of contaminants that come in the room. But that's one area. You know, how we can apply AI into monitoring the temperature and humidity of the farm, water content on the beds, and informing that back to the grower on what that's doing to it from a yield component, we think is going to be really compelling. How we can look at the mushroom. So one of the steps we do after we, you know, pick and tilt and twist and pull the mushroom out as we trim it. And so we've got a camera that looks up at the underbelly of the mushroom as we're trimming it, so we can maximize the stem length. So cut it just above where the peat moss is on the mushroom. And you can actually see a lot of things underneath the mushroom then that tell you about the quality of that mushroom and theoretically its surrounding ones as well. And so those are all areas that we, you know, we get a little carried away about how excited we are on what that can mean for future value and future yield enhancements. But we're going to need to do that with some pretty smart mushroom growers that can help us figure that out.
Yeah. Were you the CEO of your first startup?
I was not. No. So Kevin Sandu is our founder and CEO. You know, learned a lot from him and certainly felt out of depth when I initially came in to be the CEO of Tech Brew, now Forage. But thankfully, no one's asked me to leave quite yet.
How has that been, though? I mean, as far as, you know, before you were growing your baby, right? And now it's a little different, but you seem, I don't know what you were like before, but you seem just as passionate about this as I can imagine anyone being. Does it feel different?
Yeah, I'd say the biggest change is that, so in the venture capital space, when we were building Kinexus Venture Capital and Emertech, you know, you work so hard around very few decisions, and you really have to make sure you get those decisions right. And you think constantly about them. You can usually slow down the timing to fit your own journey as you try and make the right decision. And it's no less work. It's that it's a different pace to make the absolute right decision, because you make so few of them, but they mean so much. Being back in the operator's chair, particularly in the CEO role, like, you have to become a decision-making machine. And more importantly, is you've got to push decisions down as fast as you can to the right people to make them. And so that was a big adjustment. It's just really kind of flattening the organization, letting everyone know that speed is our only advantage as a startup, and letting them know that if you make the right decision quickly, that's awesome. If you make the wrong decision quickly, that's still totally fine. Don't make decisions slowly. Like, we will always win if we're on the side of speed. And so from that perspective, that was the biggest learning and adjustment I needed to make in that switch is, you know, how do I and then everyone I work with become way faster at making decisions? We can continuously push the pace. It just lets your product improve so much faster along the way. So that was the hardest part of switching, because it was super fatiguing for the first month or two. I'd just be wiped at the end of the day when I got back home, because my brain just wasn't used to, you know, making so many decisions within a day.
Sure. And other than delegating those decisions to others, what else has helped with that decision fatigue?
Just being super comfortable off imperfect information and deciding to move forward on something with that context in mind. That's been the big piece. And then the other area is, you know, in the venture capital space, your feedback loop is quite long, right? And you, like, I was in it for 5.5 years. I still have no idea if I was any good. But we, in the operator space, you get to quickly see the results of your decisions. You can say, like, oh, okay, I should have done that a bit differently, or I made this decision. I could see that person wasn't quite happy with it. Like, probably should have, you know, engaged them earlier or approached them faster. So you get the learning feedback loop faster, and you get to, you know, right your wrongs and your mistakes, and then, you know, prevent them in the future a lot faster than you do in the venture capital space.
This may be a stupid question, so feel free to talk to me like I'm a 5-year-old. In your case, where you have good technology, you're validating that technology, why is speed so important?
So when I first came on board, it's because we didn't have technology that was validated. We weren't on a farm yet, and that was super important. We got to build these robots as quickly as possible and get them on farm. Because you can test everything in the world in your own little test, you know, fake farm facility. And then you show up and, you know, one thing goes wrong. You go, oh, didn't think of that. Didn't know the sprinkler would be there. Okay, let's try this again. So that was the first piece, is get these robots built and on farm as fast as possible. But even now, the pace of iteration, the pace of building, like, if speed is a habit within the organization, I think we're always going to be on the winning side of most interactions. And so for us, we had a set of problems where we needed to build the robots and prove they work. And now we have a set of problems where we're effectively sold out of robots in 2024. We got to figure out how the heck we're going to build more and how do we increase capacity. And so I think, again, as we sit each new set of challenges, and look, one day speed of the habit might get us in a lot of trouble, and people go, that's why you need a grown-up CEO at some point to, you know, run an organization that's more process-oriented or methodical. But for today, if we can solve how we build robots faster in the next 6 months as opposed to build a great plan in the next 12 months, I think we're going to figure out that, you know, that additional time that we save, we're going to figure out so much more than we would have with the perfect plan. For us, that's really important, being milestone obsessed and continuously trying to push the pace. It's also a great way to figure out, you know, who loves that environment and wants to be there, and who's better suited for roles outside of a typical startup.
Sure. Nah, makes a lot of sense. Well, where are we going to be in 5 years if we sit down here and have a conversation? What's going to be different? What are we going to be talking about more?
Yeah, you know, it's a fascinating question. We talk about that a lot as a team too. We built a robot that's ideal for the Dutch rack farming system, which 90% of the farms in the world use this exact same process. Awesome for our robots because every farm is pretty much the same. The challenge there, and we're starting to have farms ask us this, is what's the farm of the future look like? And should we be building four robots now? And we really haven't stopped to think about that. And we need to do a better job of that. But the future of mushroom farming, now that we've proven robots work, is going to be entirely different. So how you grow the mushrooms, how you move the mushrooms or the robots, and you know, there's different kind of prevailing wisdom in the industry of, do you move the robots to the mushrooms or do you move the mushrooms to the robots, you know, much like a, you know, a car assembly facility would see. And I don't think we have the answer to that yet, but I know that they'll go from being one of the most, you know, laborious industries in agriculture, where you need to have, you know, a large farm will have 1,500 people who work for them in you know, largely in the harvesting space, into a highly automated industry that's able to track everything from, you know, the composting facility into the farm all the way to the grocery store. I don't know what that's going to look like. I know that we're going to be a big part of it, and I'm excited about that. But now that we've kind of solved the retrofit solution, we're hoping to allocate resources into thinking about what does the future farm look like, and you know, partnering with, there's big companies around the world that all they do is build mushroom farms. Those are the ones who are probably going to figure it out, and they'll need our robots to help them with it.
Super cool stuff there. I appreciate you bearing with me as I nerd out about mushrooms last week and this week, but I find it very, very fascinating. And a lot of the advantages that hyped up segments like vertical farming or like alternative proteins, as we heard last week, are happening for real, like actual profitable, real, sustainable businesses in the mushroom industry. So it just kind of baffles me how overlooked it's been, at least by me. Maybe everyone else is hyping it up more than I realize, but a lot of potential here. And I think it's super cool what Sean and the team at Forge Robotics are doing. If you'd like to learn more about that work, and I see on their website where you can also subscribe to their newsletter, you can do so at their website, which is just forage.ai, the number four, the letters AG.ai, forage.ai. I highly recommend you go there and connect with those guys and learn more about what they're doing and what's happening in this mushroom industry. Anyway, thanks so much to World Agritech for hosting a series of conversations there. We're not even maybe halfway through the conversations that I recorded at World Agritech in San Francisco, including getting to meet Sean in person as well as several others. Thank you definitely to our quarterly presenting sponsor, which is Headstorm. Learn more about them at headstorm.com. Last but never least, thank you very much for your time and for your attention. I do not ever take it lightly. I'll be back next week with another story of Ag Innovation.